Hey everybody, this is John Fusco, and you're listening to the No Film School podcast. Not many people with an interest in film have the direction to start pursuing sound at an early point in their career. It seems, rather, that through working on various projects, they come to realize how powerful a tool sound really is, and fall head over heels in love. If it's early enough in their career, there's plenty of work to be found and no turning back. For Millie Ayutru Morgan and Ai Ling Lee, this was certainly the case. All it took was a simple choice followed by years of dedication to find their way as two of the biggest sound designers in the industry today. Their latest collaboration is Damien Chazelle's First Man, one of the biggest movies of the year in both popularity and scale. The film, which tells the story of Neil Armstrong's ascent to the moon, is densely layered with filmic tricks that, when combined together, create a wholly immersive experience for the audience. And while much fuss has been made over the project's expansive visuals, it would truly be nothing without the genius sound work of these two individuals. I sat down with the pair at TIFF to discuss how they first decided to enter the business, gathering libraries of sound over the years, and their collaboration in post with director and composer on what will surely go down in history as one of cinema's greatest space stories. Enjoy. This is John Fusco. I'm here at TIFF and really excited about this interview because I think you two are the first, this is the first sound design-centric interview I think we've ever done on the show.
Oh, wow.
So why don't I, with that, let you introduce yourselves and tell us what role you played on First Man, which is a massive undertaking for a sound designer, yeah. I would say.
Well, my name is Millie Ayutru Morgan, and I was supervising sound editor along with Ai Ling Lee, who is supervising sound editor, sound designer, and re-recording mixer. I basically just supervised the dialogue, all the spoken word stuff, dialogue, production dialogue, ADR, background voices, Walla loop group. That was my focus.
And I'm Ai Ling Lee. Like what Millie had said, for me, I'm also one of the supervising sound editor together with her. And I focus on the sound design and also one of the re-recording mixers on the film.
So as supervising sound editors, who do you supervise? What is your, what is your job, so to speak, in the post-production process?
It's our job to have the overview of the sound editorial team. Like I said, I focus on the dialogue. So I worked with a dialogue editor, Susan Dawes, ADR editor, Galen Goodpaster, and Ai Ling has her crew.
Yeah, so for me, because we are more focused in the post-production process, so for the effects part of it, so I would cover generally the effects and Foley part of it. And so for First Man, since it has so much, so many unique sounds, and we want it to be more authentic, so we also did a lot of original recordings. So part of our the crew that I would supervise would include sound effect recordists, like John Fasol, who had done who was also a former sound designer, but now he's focusing a lot on original sound recording, like from Top Gun to Dunkirk and all that, till our movie, First Man. And, we also had other helps on recording the sounds. That's the first part of it. And then we did that, a little bit before we started post sound editorial. Then once post sound editorial started, then, besides Millie with her dialogue and ADR crew, for the effects side, we'd have effects editors who would, cover, the effects editing and the backgrounds. And then we have Foley editors where you have supervising Foley editors who would, basically, their job is to cue the Foley and stuff. And then also part of whom I also supervise are the Foley walkers.
So the Foley walkers, is that literally, what is a Foley walker? Is it someone, because this is all massive. I was just telling you that I finished my first short and I had one sound designer doing everything. It seems like you guys have teams of dozens of people on the team, each with their own respective jobs.
It's not dozens. When I first started doing this 30 years ago, I would work on a crew. There would literally be dozens of film sound editors and assistants. Now the crews are much smaller. I wouldn't quite say dozens. I would say in total, what, maybe?
In total at any one given time, because say for First Man, the post-production was about like maybe 4 or 5 months or so. Mm-hmm. So throughout that time period, you know, we have sound editors who come on and off. So at any one given time, I'm guessing maybe that could be a crew of, would you say, like five?
Yeah, 5 or 6.
Or six.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's a lot. It's a lot more
it's
than
a lot.
One.
Yes. It adds up once you see the credits.
Yes. Yeah.
So then how did you get into sound design? Like let's take turns.
Sure.
You know, it seems like such a specialized field. Did you go into, you said you went to City College earlier. Was that, did you always know that you wanted to be a sound designer?
No, but when I went to CCNY, I wanted to be a director and I made films there. But it's really strange because out of everybody in my class, I spent the most time on the sound. Mm. And I didn't even think of it as, oh, I want to do this for a living. I just wanted, I did a film where I used a lot of home movies to tell the story of my family. And I thought I had invented Foley because I thought, oh my God, let me put the sound of footsteps with the picture. And I thought I made this up and I recorded myself with a microphone walking down the stairs and stuff. And then later, of course, realized that that was Foley. We didn't, at City College, we didn't have a sound teacher. We didn't really. So I kind of figured it out. And one of my teachers had been a sound assistant. So, you know, I did my own recordings. And so for me, my path was different from my Ling's. For me, it was, I kind of ended up in sound by working in different aspects of film. And I found when I started doing it consistently that I really liked it. And I think people thought I was good at it and they kept giving me jobs. So I thought, let me focus on this. And that's when it got really interesting.
Hmm. How about you, Alan?
So for me, it's a little different. I had wanted to go to film school, but I didn't because it was too expensive. I'm from Singapore, and so growing up, my dad was like, he had like this kind of like a semi home theater system, sound system at home. And so, you know, we watch like movies over and over again, so like I grew up like watching like say Terminator 2 dozens of times or like going to the theater and watching Jurassic Park. I was just you just grew up like loving watching movies and, you know, I was just amazed by how powerful sound is. It can help, bring the audience into the world of the film, and it's so like immersive and it's kind of like a invisible tool. Mm-hmm. But in a sense, I kind of like got interested in that. And so, I studied a little bit on like audio engineering, for music recording and stuff, but, then found work in Singapore, in a post house for like commercials and music recording, but wanted to do film. So then I just wrote letters, unsolicited letters to like studio sound department heads or sound studio owners to see if I could visit them in LA to sit in and learn. And then I got some replies and just flew out to Los Angeles.
Wow. And then people. From those sit-ins, a job came about, or you just met the right people, or what happened?
Somehow, I saw an ad for finding work. I saw an ad posted like one of those schools. So I just applied for it. Mm. And, but because I think, I had some past experience in Singapore doing, post sound. Mm-hmm. So it made it easier, but I kind of knew that I wanted to focus more on, say, for sound, I wanted to focus more on sound effects, sound design. And because of the way that we worked in radio, TV commercials and music is
I would record and edit and mix everything. So it's a natural progression for me to also do some mix of my work.
So those are two very different paths to get to your point. Is there maybe like a more general linear path that people who are interested in sound design today could take to reach your guys' level of success, or just the exciting projects that you guys are working on?
Sure. I would say if you can go to film school, film schools now have audio departments. And I recently taught a semester at USC, and I was impressed with the quality of their sound department. Well, of course, USC is like this very expensive, very well-regarded film school, but it was like almost like a mini studio. They had every aspect of sound, and the students there got the kind of education where, especially if you go on to the graduate level, you could look for a job and you would have the skills to at least start working on a film.
And what type of skills are those?
Well, like Eileen was talking about, it's not kind of like what Eileen went through, where you have to record. They have programs where you make short films, and when you make the short film, you have to do every aspect of it, except for mixing. But you do have to record, record your film. Or you work on other people's films, you take turns, but you have to do production recording, then you have to do sound editing, and then they would have other students who specialized in mixing do the mixing. But I would say if you can't afford it, do film school. If you can't afford it, do what Eileen did, which is you just start doing it, and you get enough of experience that there will be other people, like you were saying, you made a film, you hired a sound designer, you just start doing it. Mm-hmm. And when I worked my way through the sound business, I started as an assistant, an apprentice and an assistant, because those positions were plentiful. They're very few now. Most films maybe have no apprentices, one assistant. Some don't have any assistants. So I would say develop your skills working on your own films, on your friends' films, and then try to get work as a sound editor or a sound designer.
So why do you think that is? Why do you think there are less assistant positions or positions available, I guess, in sound as a starter?
I think a lot of it has to do with the technology. When I started, it was on film, and you had to have assistants. There was so much, like, for example, when you did sound effects editing, the editor would edit on a moviola and kind of edit to the picture on this synchronizer, which ganged the sound and the picture together. Then they would hang all the pieces of sound in a bin. Then the assistant would come, and they would have footages on them, and the assistant would literally build the reel of sound and say, okay, at this footage, splice in this sound. So you needed an assistant to do that. Now it's done on a computer, right? So you need less people.
Yeah. So as you're going through your career, are you building up like sounds in a sort of like library that you maybe come back to again and again when you're designing films, or how does that work, I guess?
Yeah, I do a certain degree of that because, maybe recording voices and background voices, but with Eileen as a sound designer, she does a lot more of that.
Yeah, Eileen, can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so one of the things is like, being interested in sounds is sometimes you want fresh new sounds, but, obviously with each project, if you have the luxury to have the time and the budget, it's always good to go and get fresh recordings. But I know most of the time, especially lately, the crew sizes get smaller and budgets tighter and schedules tighter. So typically I would try to say, record as many sounds as I can. And even besides getting like a nice mic and recorder set up, I just have like a small portable handheld recorder that I carry around my purse all the time. Huh. So, anywhere you go, sometimes you may run into something weird, like, oh, that light's making a weird sound, let me just take it out and just record it. With technology, I know they aren't the best mics, but I think the key is having the recorder around, the convenience and the not to be too obvious that you're out in the public and recording, so people won't walk up to you and go like, what are you doing? So you just record them, you don't know when you're ever going to use it, if you would ever use it, but if you slowly build up your library that way. But obviously, sometimes it's you need big sounds that you can't just go up and just record it out of the blue, up from the street or anywhere else. But, you know, say if we are on trips or going on hikes, you know, it's good to just record something and just add it to the library. But of course, nowadays, especially, you know, there's a lot more sound libraries that are put up for sale.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are really good, and which was not as often that it came up with before. But I feel like the last 5 or 8 years, there's more and more of these sound libraries out for sale. And sometimes, you know, they're also good tools to just, for sound designers, it's really important to build up your library and to be familiar with it. Or, you know, creating them sometimes depending on film, you know, besides like, you know, you can record all kinds of animal sounds or even like our dog or something and, you know, process it differently. Or sometimes, you know, I had like gotten like native instruments, you know, just to recreate some synth or kind of sounds here and there for if you end up working on something sci-fi or, you know, computers or stuff.
So what kind of equipment do you use when you're out, like just grabbing sounds? Is it just like a Zoom, like?
Yeah, something like that. Zooms are pretty popular.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For me, for the small portable thing, I just had like a small, like a Sony, I think it's called M10, but unfortunately I think they don't make them anymore.
Oh no.
I know, I want one.
yeah, now if you can find them for sale, it's like really expensive. I mean, like, you know, it used to be like $100. Now it's like, if you find it for sale, it's like $500.
Wow.
I mean, they're decent, and there's a lot to know. Zoom, Olympus, you know, they make many different models. For me, it's like the size and still good quality, ease of use, and battery power.
Yeah.
That needs to last quite a bit. And then for the actual, you know, proper recording, if, you know, when we can, you know, we have like different mic setups. Like personally for me, I have like, say, 2 or 3 different mic setups that own, I would build my own MS rig with shaps and sound devices, recorders.
Do you do this as well for picking up the
I have
the
a Zoom I carry a Zoom recorder too. Mostly I like to use it for a good walla, like if I'm in a restaurant or a cafe and they're not playing music, I like to record it, because that's sort of, it's hard to duplicate in a studio. I often have to duplicate it using a loop group with a bunch of actors, but you can never really get that sound as well. So, but there's always music playing most of the time, but
I was very worried when we were when I came into the Four Seasons today, because
yes,
it was like, I thought we were going to be doing this interview in a bar downstairs in a lobby. And I was like, oh, if we're gonna have this music going on in the back, you just can't do it. So how much of your time is spent like using these sounds and organizing them digitally, and maybe even like manipulating them with certain software to find new sounds, or how do you organize your massive collection of things you've gotten throughout the years in the field?
Well, for me, it's different because I start by using the production sound that was recorded for the film.
Right.
And so I use that I start fresh every time.
Mm-hmm.
But then once I get going and I start editing, then I start using different plugins to help edit and clean up the production dialogue. One thing I really like to use now is Isotope RX6 Advanced. It has all these tools in it. It cleans out mouth clicks really well. It's good with getting rid of background sounds and clearing out the dialogue. It has all kinds of things. They have this part that where they can actually go in, and if there's like, let's say we're talking in a phone starts beeping, you can literally go in and remove the beep of the phone. So,
like, you can see the sound on the graph.
Yes,
right? And you can color it out.
So, how? Just as a follow up question to that, for, you know, the type of filmmaker that's doing a lot of this stuff himself, or for like lower budget films who are getting location sound, what are some things that you see again and again that are mistakes that our listeners should be aware of?
Well, the one thing I think is the most important thing, I really cannot emphasize this enough, is get good production sound. It's so important. And when I taught that class at USC, I kept saying that, and always roll sound, even if it's an insert shot, or, you know, sometimes it would be like someone would be flipping through a book and they wouldn't roll sound. And I'm like, why aren't you rolling sound? And they'd say, oh, we're going to put Foley in. And I would say, that's crazy. Why record Foley when you could just record the pages turning? So always roll sound, have good mic placement, make sure you're getting a good signal to noise ratio. It's so important. And then with that, then you can, you know, add the sound design and backgrounds and all kinds of things and make it even better. But if you don't have that, it'll make your work so much more difficult.
Plus, just like to add to it too, is, you know, with acting, the performance, typically, at least with the directors we've worked with, they much rather prefer the original performances.
Sure, yeah.
From a production than doing it in ADR. And so, and it always sounds much more natural that way.
Yeah.
So,
can you talk a little bit, now that we're getting into like your work with directors, can you talk about your sort of collaborative process with Damien? How involved is he in the post-production process and sound? Is he like coming to you with ideas for like how a rocket taking off should sound like? Are these things that you discuss prior to post-production?
Yeah, say like on First Man, with Damien, much early on during pre-production, he showed us the animatics that he worked on, and it had sounds in there. Okay. And those animatics were a good guide for like what they need to cover in production, and also the sounds in there, it also kind of gives us an idea like what we need to cover besides not reading the script. And then he also talked to us about like, you know, what's important to him, the Saturn V rocket, you know, he wanted to get the sound right, because, you know, it was and still is the most powerful rocket in the world. So, you know, he wanted to sell the fury and the insanity of it. And so, you know, we start looking into like various NASA archives. They had sound recordings there, you know, because we wanted to be authentic as much as we could, besides embellishing it some more later on. But it's hard to find like good original recordings, especially from back then.
Sure.
So we embarked on like trying to get in touch with as many rocket companies as we could. And, you know, it's good that this film had NASA and Defense Department's cooperation, so it makes it easier. So we recorded like, you know, various rockets, including, we were lucky enough, like this past February, SpaceX launched their biggest rocket ever, the Falcon Heavy. Mm. And, you know, it is like to date the closest in size, I mean, in power, to the Saturn V. So we're lucky enough that, you know, we could plant like mics that are like on the launch pad, closer than not usual, that access wise and distance that we are comfortable with,
right.
without gears. So, you know, we could get as close as like 300 to 400 yards away from the launch site, and then, you know, a quarter mile, 3 miles, and so on and so forth. And this way we could capture, you know, like the ignition and the various launch sounds for the different distances. The sound changes, the characteristic of the launch changes, you know, depending on the distances, you recorded. Even the sonic booms, when it, you know, re-enters the atmosphere, you know, we captured all that and used that, like, say for the sonic booms, we used that in the X-15 sequence. And we also recorded a whole bunch of other rockets from, like, the other SpaceX rocket in ULA and some other, like, smaller lunar lander development companies out in the Mojave Desert, just so we could sneak as much of like original sounds as we can in the film. And also to help with the feeling of the Saturn V launch, because we wanted to be able to feel it more. So with the low end, so we also went to JPL and recorded their acoustic chamber that is like used to test equipment, mm-hmm. just make sure they could withstand the launch environment. So the acoustic chamber is like powered by nitrogen gas to create that sound and to mimic a launch environment. Mm. So, yeah. We did a whole bunch of other recordings, but yeah.
That is like the insane amount of, I think, like research and detail that you have to put into like designing something like this is just.
Yeah. Early on in the film, you know, Damien had a whole list of movies for us to watch, you know, like going to space and like watch Das Boot.
Okay. Yeah.
Because it's like, you know, they're trapped in this. No, right. I mean, they're not really trapped. No, they are like living in this submarine doing that, you know, mission. And it's the sounds, the creaking and, you know, even though it seems so solid, but, you know, it can be so fragile, you know, the deeper they go. So same thing with this, with the rockets.
Yeah. So much of the tension is built from claustrophobia throughout the entire movie. And like sound is huge in that respect in this film, particularly. It sounds like the way that Damien was giving you notes in terms of like it was how he wanted things to feel rather than like a explicit like we're going to use like this type of sound. Mm-hmm. Is there a sort of note, a perfect note or a perfect way of giving notes that for directors to give their sound team to get the kind of vibe that they want?
Well, I mean, I think he seems to go for more of like, you know, describing how he wants the scene to feel, you know, say these cockpit spacecraft scenes, you know, he would, you know, say, he wants to build it up more visceral, just like he wants it surprising and unexpected.
He would also say he wanted to be terrifying.
Yeah, terrifying. Yeah. Almost like, sometimes almost like a horror film.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But he said a good horror film like Rosemary's Baby.
Okay.
Yeah. Watch that too. Really? You know, he wants it like, or sometimes, you know, to help with the claustrophobia, you know, he kind of described it as like some of those Terrence Malick films. Hmm. Because they are in such tight environment, so we play up things like, you know, like even when they flip a switch or grab a control stick, you would hear like a close up glove creaks and things like that. And then, you know, he talked to us about how he wants the sound of deep space to feel, to have this like chilling effect, but mm-hmm. not calming. It's almost like the astronauts are leaving the world of the living and heading towards like a place where no man's supposed to go.
For me, he kept emphasizing how he wanted when they're on Earth, it had to sound like a documentary. It had to sound real, that the sound shouldn't call attention to itself, that just the way he used 16mm film and you see the film grain, mm-hmm. the equivalent for that would be to hear the grit on the production sound. Mm-hmm. Like, don't clean it up too much, which sometimes that's what you want. And I'll spend a lot of time like making the dialogue sound pristine, but that wasn't the case here. It had to be intelligible, but it had to sound more like a documentary where you were aware of the movement in the room and the, maybe it wasn't perfectly on mic all times. We used, you know, we'll use the mix track instead of the lavaliers, things like that, to a degree where it was interesting because when I worked with Susan Dawes, who's a dialogue editor too, and we would clean up these scenes and we'd have these discussions. Do you think it's too clean? And then say, well, okay, let's send it in. Cause we'd do both Eileen and I, we'd do our work and then they would ask for stuff and we'd give it to them. And then if they put it in the Avid tracks, that meant they liked it. Huh. And that meant we were working, you know, in the right direction. And sometimes he would bounce it back and say, you know, Mission Control is too clean. Make it sound a little bit more like the real room.
Is this done kind of simultaneously with the edit, or is the edit finished before you guys?
It's simultaneous. They start before we do, but yeah. Eileen actually came on pretty, how many weeks were they into the picture edit when you started? She started first to provide sound effects.
Possibly 3 or 4 weeks into the director's cut.
Mm.
Yeah.
So then how did your relationship with Justin, the composer, were you guys kind of bouncing ideas off of each other, or which came first, the sound design, the score?
Well, no, the unique relationship for Justin and Damien is that, you know, when the, I think, you know, it's possibly like even during pre-production, Justin would already be working on the music, the, you know, maybe coming up with sounds, the theme and whatnot, and bouncing ideas back and forth with Damien. And so by the time for us, when we start post-sound, that would be quite a few, you know, pretty good mock-ups, and they would have kind of pretty good ideas on where and when, where there's music or not. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, basically when Tom Cross was the picture editor and Damien, when they are cutting the film, they would be cutting in conjunction with Justin's music. And Justin, his office would be like right next to them. Mm. And so so by the time we're on, so we get these turnovers from the Abbott, from them. And that way I kind of know, what the music is like, what frequency range, what the mood is, and so we can add sounds to it that won't clash and complement it. And also, one of the things that Damien mentioned earlier on is he really likes how music meets sound design. You know, so he lists a few like Stanley Kubrick films.
Yeah.
That also allows me, like, when, so that means like when we start working on the sound design, we could pick sounds that could then segue, you know, hopefully a bit more seamlessly into the music or out of it. Even during the Saturn V launch, yeah. That, you know, typically they started off cutting the scene thinking like, oh yeah, it should be all sound effects because you want to hear it. And but you know, they felt like the scene was didn't quite work for them, so they then had Justin score it, so they cut the scene to the score. Hmm. And then we added the sounds to it. Hmm. And Justin, knowing that there will be like these loud like constant roars of explosions and
yeah.
whatnot.
Yeah.
So he was smart enough and very tastefully like picked instrumentations that won't conflict too much with the sound, so that, you know, by the time we mixed it, we could just play everything up and, you know, you just feel it. And also with the sound effects, you know, when we are cutting it, we are always in constant, like, just make sure we don't like add sounds that's like, say, too much percussion, like constant hits that would like mimic the
staccato or
sorry, it's hard for me to pronounce it. so it won't clash too much with the music. So.
Great. Well, it sounds like there is such a beneficial relationship of having sort of the score and the sound design going at the same
definitely. Time. Definitely, because. You would be surprised how many times on films, like the sound design team will work really hard on a sequence and then they come to the mix and there's this really loud music all over everything and you can't hear any of it.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, you know, that's always a give and take in a mix, because sometimes the scene plays better with mostly music. And not, no, but it's just, you know, it helps everyone when, if the composer, starts off early and then sound, and then so you kind of have more of a communication back and forth on how best to give each other moments. Because, sometimes we do run into mm-hmm. things like when, sometimes, like, say, if there's a big explosion scene or, gunshots and you have like a big instrument hit on an explosion that would then be covered by some effects.
And the thing that's really interesting about this film is there I would say three major set pieces. Two of the three are no music. Right. So the X-15, there's no music. The Gemini sequence, there's no music. But then, and then it's really lovely when the Apollo rocket goes off. It's this really nice, and Eileen explained how that worked, but this really nice combination of sound effects and music.
Yeah, and I think also the absence of sound in general of anything. I mean, science fiction, it should be a rule that there is no sound in an exterior in space, in my opinion. But, you know, it worked incredibly well for this film because...
Oh, good.
Yeah, because they're so isolated in a way. You know, you have the score, you have the absence of sound, and you have the sound design. And when they all sort of play together like that, it really brings this emotional response, I think, out of the audience. And great. Well, thanks. I don't want to take all your day.
It was fun talking to you.
Yeah.
could you give me one piece of advice each for aspiring sound designers to have a successful career or to break into the industry, I suppose?
I say, you know, for me, like, you know, just keep recording or creating sounds or even volunteer on any kinds of projects. It could even be a commercial or video game or short films, TV or features. That way you kind of, a lot of it for me is about doing it. Mm-hmm. And then you know what works and what doesn't. And also then you also get to build up a, you know, like a little reel maybe to show.
True.
Yeah.
Yeah, I completely agree with that, and also talk to people. I find I learn, there are times when I work so hard and I don't want to take a lunch break, I want to keep working, but I often find that when I have lunch with sound designers and other sound people, I'll learn these things. Like they'll say, oh my God, there's this new plugin or this new microphone or whatever. And so, you know, talk to other sound people.
That's great, tricks of the trade.
Yep.
Well, I hope that, this was an informative interview for everyone. I think it was great to hear this from my part, just because the sound is, I was ecstatic to get this interview. The sound in this movie is amazing, and the movie is great too. So
thank you. Thanks
for sitting down with me.
Thank you for talking to us.
Yeah. Thanks for listening. If you like the podcast, please subscribe to us on whatever podcast platform you use. And if it's iTunes, go ahead and give us a rating. You can tune in on Thursdays for Indie Film Weekly, our weekly news show, and every Monday for an interview episode like the one you just heard. I'm John Fusco. You can follow me on Twitter at @Jim_John_Jim, and you can follow No Film School @No Film School. Until Indie Film Weekly, we'll see you later.